Well, welcome, faithful Wednesday morning attendees. And you made it across Market Street if you had to. It was very hard to cross. And you aren't even dressed in black and orange, so that's good. my name is Kathy Gorosh, and I'm the moderator for today's session, and which is linking vulnerable drug-using populations to quality care and services. We have three presenters, and we'll go about 15, 20 minutes each, and whatever you need, and take questions and discussions at the end. And on behalf of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs, who is supporting the HIV/AIDS section on this presentation, welcome. Our first presenter is Wendy Weshberg, who is going to talk about reaching and linking substance-abusing vulnerable women in South Africa to HIV testing and care after PEPFAR. Wendy is the Senior Director of the Substance Abuse Treatment Evaluations and Interventions Research Program at RTI International, and is also adjunct professor at both UNC School of Public Health and Psychology at NCSU, and adjunct associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke. She's funded by the NIAAA, NICHD, NIDA, and CDC. She's published in Gender, Ethnicity, Outreach, Substance Abuse Treatment, HIV Risk, and Cultural Adaptations. So Wendy, would you like to come up?
So, good morning. I'm so glad we have some people to talk to. We weren't sure if we were going to have a discussion, but we actually do hope we can have a discussion with whoever is here after. I wanted to make sure that for the three of us, we thank Dion, who wasn't here and actually brought us together to do this talk. So Dion Jones is a project officer at NIDA and is a really special woman who has really promoted women's work in our field. And because she works for the government, she had planned to come, but sometimes things happen and it wasn't in her control that she couldn't be here. But we do thank her and have to think of all the other people that aren't here as well because of what happened in the East Coast, where I'm headed back to today, I hope. So I have a lot of co-authors, and it's not just co-authors here, but as a part of anything I do, there's a lot of people that bring me to where I am. So I stand up here, and it's pretty crowded, as you can imagine. I've been lucky. I have no other disclosures, but I've been funded by a lot of institutes. NIDA has funded me since I got my PhD, and all along I've been able to do this women's work, so I'm really grateful that it has blossomed. And as science, because I'm actually an addiction clinician, psychologist by training, one of the things about science, who would have thought I'd become a scientist, is asking the next question. And like the person I've known the longest in this room is Hillary right here. We've known each other over 20 years, Hillary? Our work just keeps expanding by asking that, you know, science is advancing the next question, and we never get it right, but we keep, as long as we're inquisitive and we're thoughtful and empathetic and we're touching people's lives, we get better. So that comes to the question of who are these vulnerable women that we reach? Some people call them MARPs, like most at risk. Well, I did one of those career talks at NIDA in after I'd been doing the women's co-op for years in North Carolina, and I got asked to go to South Africa, and I said, what am I going to do in South Africa? I don't know if I fit. And they said, oh, I'm sure you will. And I said, well, I'll look for substance-abusing women, and I do mixed methods. So when I was starting to look for substance-abusing women, I tended to find women who were sex workers. So I learned a lot in the process. So, you know, I've been like a student in the world, and we keep learning on this journey. And here you can see homeless women, and by the way, all of our pictures we have releases on, so I want to say that. But if you feed them, they will come, as you can see, these women that came for eating at a focus group. And also women who work in the bush, and also women who work in the townships under a lean-to. I took that picture in 2003. I still show that picture. The other woman was in a homeless shelter. But women who become sex workers in South Africa, it's not exactly like a career choice, though they may end up being a career sex worker. in South Africa because of lack of equity and lack of equality, which, you know, equity, because of lack of equity, we have equality and lack of equality in the world, and that's why we have so much HIV among women. And because they have to pay for school fees and school books, boys are favored and girls drop out of school. So it's all, when you think of social and structural and these contextual factors, girls lose. And so what do they have an option to do? And they still have to support their families. What they have is their body. And I've always said this statement in one of these very first focus groups that I did when I was first on my learning, still learning, but when I was trying to gather this textual information, was one of these women said to me when I was 8 years old, my mother said my body was my bank account. And I've never forgotten that. Even when I've gone to India to work, this 8 years old, the girls in the brothels were 8 years old, and it just stuck with me. So it's painful, the stuff we do, and yet we want to think we're going to make a difference. So what are the issues that women who use drugs and drink? So obviously they use drugs, and they told me they use drugs to gain a little confidence. So it's kind of the paradox. We teach women to be empowered, to take care of themselves, to protect themselves, as you'll see with the intervention. But they also smoke DACA, which is marijuana. They sprinkle it. Nowadays, we're seeing a whole lot more opiate use, but they and cocaine use. But they also use Tai White to get a little edge on their marijuana, which they call DACA. Gives them the ability to not feel shy and talk to men and cook them to get them in to do tricks. And there are pretty bad relationships because there's really not great communication beyond that. And as I said, minimal education, lack of skills. And so, of course, I zeroed in on issues of condom skills because there were a lot of condoms breaking. They were given condoms, but they didn't really know how to use them. A lot of air on the top. And violence was something I learned a great deal about when I went to South Africa. I never had really, wasn't a violence person, but had to become like a quick study. And the comorbidity, as we can imagine, it's not just STIs and HIV, but there was also TB. And resources and stigma were issues, like resources that women couldn't get to, or if they said, if I go there, they treat me badly because I'm a sex worker. So the original Women's Co-op, for the sake of CDC here, Nita, thank you. You do interventions, and I guess I'm not politically correct in thinking about when CDC looks at your interventions, but I did get blessed as the best evidence, even though I didn't expect that, but that was kind of nice. That really sets you up to do a lot of other things. But what I want to point out is that the core elements of the intervention are important in that we do a personalized risk assessment and we work on goal setting, but we deal with drugs and sex. The original intervention was drugs and sex, but I added the next generation of it with violence. And here is where we've been doing this intervention around. We've also packaged it. We're ready for scaling up. We're looking at our options. Our USAID has actually taken our intervention to look at scaling it up in sub-Saharan border areas in the countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We have lots of adaptations going on currently, so we're a little busy, including even couples work and in the criminal justice system. So what I want to bring us back to as this talk is it isn't all perfect, and that's what makes us scientists, is that we have to look at the good, but we have to look at the bad. So my frustration in the first generation of working with sex workers in Pretoria, South Africa, was that a lot of the women were drug dependent, they didn't access treatment, and though we had great follow-ups and we had great behavioral outcomes and we published all that, we also had tremendous amount of high prevalence, and I didn't turn my phone off. God, I should have just said that. Sorry. And you can see the prevalence here of 63% among sex workers and those women who were not sex workers, but they were all drug users. And we didn't, at that time, there wasn't the access to ARVs, like the government saying, oh, we've reached 80% of the people. There was a press release a few weeks ago from the government in South Africa. We've reached 80% of the people that need HIV services in the country, and they're on ARV. And I'll point out to you, it's not necessarily true. So the next generation of the study that we started in the last year, and we just started randomization in the end of May, and you'll see some of my staff who've actually stayed with me, what we needed to do. In the last study, why in the time of PEPFAR changes, and why I put that in the title, is that a clinic that was sponsored by PEPFAR, a big NGO called Right to Care, they took over my space and they started doing ARVs. But by the time we worked out the contracts and the negotiations, a lot of the women in my study died. And it was very, very hard for us because the mode age was 23. 75% of those women had had children. So they were young children, young women, and they were dying. And by the time we got all the contracts in place and they took over my staff, which is everything you want to do, but there's time. When people say in South Africa, just now, I'll see you just now, that could be months. When I always say to staff, is it just now? Is that a New York minute? So, you know, it's this cultural thing of everything takes time. So everything takes time. I got another grant, and this grant actually will do a better job because we are responsible for linking. Talk about not delegating, but being responsible for case management. So we are doing the seek, test, treat, and retain piece, and let me tell you, still got problems. So we are, and then when we bid this, we thought we'd have mobile units, and then that PEPFAR money went away too. So there have been a lot of changes with PEPFAR's priority. Instead of just doing services like they did that clinic I talked about, they did the mobile unit when we bid this, and then they're saying, well, that's going back to the health departments. Health departments really aren't organized yet. They even had a wellness program that they pulled out. And so everything we thought we were going to do changed, and we had to revamp this while we won it. And so we reorganized how we were going to do this grant without the mobile units, and the health department said, oh, they'll work with us, but they're not organized yet, and so we just replanned what we were going to do with outreach and the hotspots, and we randomized the whole city. As you can see, this is all Tshwane, which is called Pretoria, and we are of the people. And we went back, we had GIS mapped all the hotspots we'd been to before, and then we randomized those clusters, and here's the staff working in our staff room. Every day, we actually work where they're going to go out and do outreach. And so let me just show you where we are now with our frustration of saying, well, now we know how to get them. We do the testing. We're a certified HIV testing clinic in our field site. And the women who are positive, and I want to show you that in a second, and we can link them to treatment. And so you think it's all going to work now because we're in control. Not so. But I do want to show you some really interesting thing about differences between my two groups, the standard women who are in the standard clusters of the city, and those are not. There's a lot of drug use in some, and again, this is just to date. So we're going to have over 1,000 women in the study before we're done. So this is just a small sample of over 100. But a lot of opiate use and a lot of cocaine, and things change as I've been watching over 12 years of working there, how drug use just filters around. In lower parts of, like Cape Town, where I'm working in another study, you don't even see this opiate and cocaine use. You see a lot of methamphetamine use. So there are differences in the country about drug use. Now, as you can see, these women are older than last time. These women are still pregnant. But look at the differences between sex worker and non-sex worker. Last time I showed you, there were 63% positive. Now they're 66% positive. They were like 32% or 33% non-sex worker. I think it was 32%. Now they're 35% positive. Unemployed. Well, they say unemployed. I think it's employed. Oops, might be a mistake. And then you can see they're not very educated. Have they given birth? Well, last time it was like 75%, and it's a little less here. So we want to link them to treatment, but we're really having a problem linking them to treatment because how far they live, really getting them connected, because these are new women. We haven't established ourselves with some of these women, so there's a lot of lack of trust of getting us connected, and, you know, outreach sometimes isn't an initial contact to being in our study. Of course, there's always gatekeepers, whether it's the brothel owner, whether it's the security, or the dealer, because these are drug-using women as well. Or unavailable, or, you know, this isn't worth it. We don't give them a grocery voucher that's worth the money that they're going to make. Many of these women who are sex workers, they don't have to be a sex worker to be in the study, but they're drug users. So, and also in South Africa, when I started this study, they were going into wintertime, where we have summertime here. So the weather can be a real factor. They don't want to get out, and it's wet and cold. And these buildings don't have heat, and so people don't want to get out, and the roads are muddy because there aren't really paved roads. So there are all these barriers, and it's long. If you think there's distance in traveling, anywhere to get anywhere takes a long time. So here are the solutions. We establish trust. We keep going back in. We create a really nice field site. Of course, I love decorating. I think Hillary knows this. Every field site I've ever had, I go in and I buy all kinds of stuff, and we painted it yellow, we made it beautiful, we put in a shower, we did a kitchen. We get donated food from all the grocery stores around where our site is. We go out and do outreach with bags of food, so we actually are offering something to the women. We send over toiletries and donated clothes every time we go. We send a container of stuff when I move to staff over there to live. And we work weekends, and of course, childcare is a no-brainer. And we work our community advisory board. We make them not just come to a meeting. They work our resources and our referral system. I just pulled this data because I have a DSMB meeting on Monday just to show you. So all those women that you saw that were positive, they have to go for clinical staging. Maybe some of them don't have a T-cell count, you know, at the level where we could get them ready for ARV. So clinical staging, they'll put them on like Bactrim to get them, so for their TB. But you can see only 8 of those women are on ARVs. Some of them stopped taking. Why? Because I already had a baby. I don't need to be on ARVs anymore. So they only get on ARVs while they're pregnant, and then they stop. Or the CD4 count isn't high enough. Still waiting for their results and still have to go for staging. Now, they don't go for staging. And what we found out is this, our solutions. We had to create a relationship with the management at the clinics. We had to offer in-service training about what we were trying to do so we weren't strangers. And, you know, there's an issue of stigma as well. So we really had to work, and there's also confidentiality. We can't talk about it being a research project, but we're just like a resource support, like family for the women, even to get them to rehab. So as you can see, rehab is an issue. If we could get the women stable and off drugs, maybe they'll do a better job if they're on ARVs. So, and here's a really interesting one, as you can see, about IDs. This is not supposed to be a barrier, but it is. Clinics are not supposed to say you have to have, like from the old apartheid ages of having an ID, like a passport to get around, but they say you have to have an ID to get on ARVs. So we're trying to work with the Homeland Security Office to say, how can we get pictures for the women in our study without disclosing anything? So that's a real problem. And of course, we're working with the women with their goals and the donated food. Some women on ARV, I remember from the first study, one woman came to us crying. Their family had rejected her. She couldn't take her meds. She had no food. She came in and had tea with us, and we gave her a bag of food leaving. If you're poor, remember, they go to bed hungry. So food security is an issue, and making sure that they have food to be able to take their meds. The newest thing that happened in the last week, that this was already uploaded, is that Jackie, who's on a co-author and lives there, said to me, the women are afraid to take the meds because they're going to get stolen because people are taking them and smoking them with DACA. It's called Wanga. And so would we start keeping the meds at the office? And I said, well, I need to go through IRB to find out if they can then take their meds and self-medicate because we can't dispense meds for them. And so that's another issue that people are afraid because they live in shacks to have their own meds because they're going to get stolen, sold, or smoked with DACA call, you know, and so that's a big deal. And so there are all these issues in their lives that create these barriers for getting on ARVs. So ultimately, I leave you with, as I said, nothing's perfect when you're working in the ground. You think you're in control. The more you think you're in control, you're not. But we are trying, and we're integrating all of this, as you say, seek, test, and treat. We can get them tested. There are some things we can do, but case management is a moving target. Staff have to be flexible and work as a team. We don't send our staff out except as a team because of security. You know, I drive alone there in South Africa, and some guy tried to rob me for my cell phone a few months ago, and I just slammed his hand out of my car. But, you know, most people, it's just kind of scary to work in a setting like that. So, but it is, it makes such a difference. This is just a picture of the intervention that's been packaged. But ultimately, I leave you with, we care about what we do, we're persistent. And in the shortages of PEPFAR, you know, the priorities change, the health departments are limited and stressed, but the head of the health department in Tswane and works for the provincial government is on our CAB. This woman, doctor, she really believes in us and is helping us with the linkages. And they even want to get the mobile units up and running to work with us again. But it just takes a while to get things going, and we were on a timeline as well. So, as I said, we work on our feet. So we work on our feet, but we also have 3 IRBs, our U.S. one, the local one, and the South African medical one. So we learn as we go, but ultimately it is about the woman. So thanks. That's it. So do I have a moment for questions?
Yeah, you could take a couple.
Any couple? Anyone? Narita.
And not fully disclosing that you're doing an intervention. Did I hear that when you were talking? So my question is, how do you coordinate these three IRBs?
We do disclose that there's an intervention. You mean that by chance on the consent, some communities will get, because remember, it's a randomized cluster community design. So some communities will get something and some will just get treatment as usual, which is HIV testing and referral. So everybody gets that referral. So how do I coordinate all the IRBs? That has been a lot, you know, always like my issue is timing. Who do I go to first? Because everybody always has changes as far as, you know, my translations and what I do and who I defer to the most. So that's always been a juggle, and you won't believe how many modifications I have as I'm there. Oh, we forgot this. Oh, we need this. And then the U.S. wanted a certificate of confidentiality. Oh, great. But what does that mean in South Africa? So RTI is a very, very strict IRB. So I tend to go through them, and then I send stuff to South Africa, and if they want changes, I then send a mod through RTI because they're very fast. But the ones in South Africa, they want it way ahead. You have to pay for everything. Every IRB you go to, you pay. You don't necessarily budget all that money when you wrote your proposal. But I try to get stuff ahead of time, and then I know I'm going to do mods. The ones in South Africa, once you go through, all they want is just your final product that I've got a mod in the U.S. Did that make sense? Okay. Great.
I know it's complex.
It is such a juggle. And then also, they all want, like, some want a progress report 6 months. Some want just a yearly renewal. I have to do a yearly renewal, of course, in the U.S. But it IRB is tricky. Especially now that the staff say, can we change eligibility? A lot of sex workers are just alcohol users, not these two drug users and so on. So, think of all the electronic change. Everything we get is downloaded every day electronically. Everything we do is electronic. Data collection is electronic. So everything you do is going to change, and so you have to go through IRB. Any other questions? Nisa. The initial adaptation? Okay, so every study gets tweaked a little bit more. So we do somewhat of adaptation to the context or to the population or to that area, if that's what you're asking. So there's always some adaptation, some formative stuff that has to occur if it's not from the CAB, if it's not from focus groups. Like we spent 2 years doing the adaptations with the couples, with the women's and the men's intervention, because there was so much more information we needed to put in on conflict resolution and communication and so on to fill those. But back to the package one, we did a lot of, we did pre-testing, actually with CDC was involved with the pre-testing of that, and pilot testing for the actual packaged one, because it couldn't be as extensive as the couples intervention. So everyone has gone through some pilot and a series of testing and modification and editing, and there comes a point where you have to like say, okay, put a date on this one, we're done. Until the next time. Okay?
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, we can take additional questions at the end.